full of energy. Turn to someone to your left and your right and look them in the eye and say, there's a lot going on. Obviously that's true. Let me ask you a warm-up question in keeping with that then. My question is, what's going on? What's going on? Entropy. Entropy is going on. That would be our number one answer, wouldn't it? That'd be the lead. What's going on in your life? What's going on in the world? What's going on in the universe? You choose the scope at which you answer, but I'll give you 8 seconds to contemplate, and then you're going to tell me what's going on. All right, tell me, what's going on? Entropy is going on. What else? Healing is going on. I like that. Yeah? Fighting entropy is going on. There you go. Chaos is happening, but we're bringing order to the game. Yeah. A battle is going on. Does it feel like a battle is going on for you guys this morning? How many of you feel like, oh yeah, I'm in a big wrestling match? All right. What else? Life is going on, which is some combination of entropy, battle, and healing. Yeah. Yeah, Andrew.
Death and taxes
are going on. Yeah, I hear they're unavoidable. Sal?
My first Super Bowl.
Your first Super Bowl is going on. Yeah. Sally's from the UK, and so she's more excited about the Super Bowl than any World Cup ever. Yeah, for sure. Cool. What else? New beginnings are going on. Yeah. Who's disruption is going on? Who's got the best answer? Final answer is, yeah. Who is that? All right. Francesca.
Trying to
keep little ones alive. Is that what you said? Says the young mom. Yes. Yeah, that's 90% of what's going on. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of life is trying to figure out what's going on and what's scope to evaluate life on. You know, like, what's going on? Well, you know, today my life is about, getting to work on time or something like that. But is that what life is about? Maybe your Monday morning isn't about getting to work on time. Maybe it's about bringing your godly purpose to the earth in chaos. Or maybe it's about the curtain falling on this age and the new heaven and new earth that is emerging into a new age of eternity. I mean, there's so many ways to think about it. And a lot of how we live life, a lot of how you live life, I think, depends on what you think about primarily. Do you think about getting to work on time, or do you think about life purpose, or do you think about the purpose of the universe? And that should influence us. It's just hard to know how sometimes. But I do think a lot of a healthy life is trying to live in reality and remembering that reality is usually bigger than what's in front of your face any given moment. You understand what I'm saying? We're doing a sermon series out of the book of Revelation, which is the last book of the Bible. It's called Revelation because it's this grand prophetic revelation that was given by Jesus, it says in the first line, to John, this apostle. He was the last surviving of Jesus' original 12 disciples. And he's in prison on this island called Patmos. And he has this grand revelation where he sees behind the curtain and sees some of the big epic things that are happening, not just on the earth, but on the universe around the earth. Revelation is a very symbolic, prophetic display of a grand reality, grander than one might think, just staring at what's in front of one. I was thinking about reality this week in my small way. I was saying my bedtime prayers on Thursday night, I think it was. And Sony and I are in that stage of life where the kids have gone off to college, you know, and so we have an empty house for the first time. in 20 years. And so, you know, quite naturally, I end every night with anxiety for my children, you know. So I was just praying about them. I was praying about my girl, JoJo, my eldest. And I'm just going through this kick recently about, oh, you know, Lord, like, what's really going on? How should I really think about life? What should I really be pursuing? How should I really be praying? So I was trying to remember what I knew God had told me for sure about my little girl. You know, because I have all these feelings for her and stuff like that. It's like, okay, Lord, what is it that you have told me specifically about this young lady? Because I do want to be praying in keeping with that. And I had this recollection. This happened like the second day that she was home from the hospital. And I was she was crying in the middle of the night, so I was up at night holding her. I was the guy that always took the late night pacings. And I remember I was giving her the tip of my little pinky finger to suck on, you know, to sort of settle her out, you know. And I was praying over her, as one does in that situation. And what was going on was that when she came out, we had named her Sarah Johanna. Sarah after my great-grandmother. And Johanna was a name that Sonia felt like the Lord said that we should call her. And then, after we got her home the first day, Sonia decided that she should be named Johanna Sarah. Yeah, that was my response. It's like... Really? Like, I got to go back to the office and I got to change her name now? It's like, we're kind of busy. It's like, no, it has to be the other way. So I was actually praying about that. Like, what's your name? And then the voice of the Lord just spoke. I just remember just feeling it like cascade across my back as I was holding this little package. And the voice said, she is as the prophet John. The prophet John, you know, John who wrote Revelation and stuff. And of course, John is the masculine form of Johanna, you know. So it's like, I got to go back to the office and change your name. and from then on, she was Johanna. She became JoJo. And that's how everybody here knows her. But I had that recollection. And I think the Lord was saying to me, like, remember that she's a prophet. Remember that she's a prophet. I had this other memory, like the way we found out that we were having Jeremiah is 15 months later. We were living in this cramped little apartment, and JoJo, she would, you know, just getting used to walking. She was playing with some blocks. She got up and she toddled across the room. She went over to Sonia, who was sitting on the sofa, and grabbed her shirt and put her chubby little hand on Sonia's tummy and said, "Baby, baby," and then turned around and walked back to her toys. And I was like, you know, she barely had any words. Like, she couldn't walk. And how did she know that babies came from mommy's tummies? I did not know. And then it hit us. We got to go get a pregnancy test. And that's how we found out we were pregnant with Jeremiah. It's like, little 15-month-old prophetess. It's like, dang, that's pretty good. That's pretty good, right? And so, you know, it's born to be a prophet. You know, haven't seen that full blown in her. But I pray that it's like, you know, just raise up my little girl prophet, Lord, and reveal yourself to her, give her revelations for heaven. And then I fell asleep, and then I went to bed. I get up the next morning, and I'm having my coffee, and I get a text from her. It said, "Dad, I just woke up with this dream. And in this dream," from JoJo, "and in this dream, I saw you at a book reading. I've been really trying to double down on my writing. I feel like that's what the Lord has led me to do." And she said, "I see you at this book reading. Only you were reading from an anthology of short fiction that you wrote, which I don't normally write. And the crowd was listening to you. And I was just so proud of you, Dad, that I was just crying as you were reading that. And then I woke up in tears. And I just feel like maybe you should concentrate on writing that kind of stuff too." And so it was nice to just think that I could do anything that would make my little girl proud of me, because we're at that stage of life, right? But I felt like that's obviously confirmation of what I was praying before. Like, you know, she's having little prophetic words, even for me, and I feel like that was God's gift to me. So yeah, pray for your little prophet. I'd share that story, because it's heartwarming. That's a nice story to pray, to share. You know, it's the father-daughter sort of thing. but to illustrate the point that realities are always worth remembering. They're worth remembering in every relationship that we have. They're worth remembering in our families. They're worth remembering while we're on the job. They're worth remembering while we're at church or in the gym or whatever else is going on. That there's always something that God had in mind from the beginning for you and for everyone around you in every situation, from the smallest person to the grandest earthly institution to the universe itself. God's realities are being worked out. He doesn't forget. He always remembers. We sometimes do forget. We sometimes don't remember. And it is a worthy exercise to try to peer behind the curtain on occasion, to plug into not just the drama of your life, but the drama of the ages of which your life is a part. Truly, your life is a part of the drama of the ages. God foresaw you from the very beginning. And that's a message that the book of Revelation gives us time and time again. In the first week of the book of Revelation series, we talked about the fact that there is a big reality behind the curtain and what that means. There is a big reality called death, into which we are all heading, but it need not be permanent. And that's a good way to start thinking about life and Revelation. Last week we talked about the necessity of being real about our weaknesses. That's a good way to begin to live life with God. John gets a dictation from Jesus of messages for seven churches throughout Asia Minor, and we went through several of those messages, basically the Lord just speaking to churches, to groups of believers, and saying, hey, you're doing great over here, but over here, you're not doing so great, and be careful, or that will get you. That will come back and bite you in the acole, it counts. You know, don't be the sort of person who goes through life content with your strengths while ignoring your weaknesses, because the enemy only needs one weakness to take you down, to ruin your testimony or to snare your life. And this week we're going to take a look at chapters 4 and 5 in the book of Revelation, which has a lot to do with it's the beginning of the grand revelation of the drama of the ages. And I'm going to do it in a weird way that's going to require some patience and attention from you guys. In other words, it probably won't work. I'm going to read the entirety of Revelation 4 and 5. Now, they're both fairly short chapters. They read like symbolic poetry, right? They're these landscapes, only they're heavenly landscapes, and they're filled with wild-looking creatures and trumpets and lightning and thunder and stuff like that. So I'm going to read them, and then I'm going to interpret the symbolism as I go. If you're used to interpreting symbols, if you're used to interpreting dreams or prophecies and stuff like that, you could probably read these chapters and understand them fairly easily. But I understand that not all of us are. And people read the book of Revelation and it trips them out. They're like, what? This looks like some sort of surreal painting from Dali or something. But no, it's sort of a symbolic code that is meant to illustrate things for us. And what we see in Revelation 4 or 5, nothing less than visions of the headquarters of heaven, the throne room of God. In the book of Revelation, the throne room of God is not like, you know, the high lofty place where we go when we die. The throne room of God is like headquarters for all that exists. It's not the high sort of lofty attic to the house. It's the center of everything. And so we're getting a picture of that. Are you ready? All right, so John is having a chat with Jesus. It's been very impressive. He just gets these seven messages that he delivers to these seven churches. And then here's how it goes. After this, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. So his vision continues. He's kind of just been on earth, and now he looks up and he can see into the next realm. The door has been kicked open. Very cool. And the voice I heard first speaking to me, Jesus' voice, like a trumpet, said, come up here and I will show you what must take place after this. Now let me show you what's next. At once I was in the spirit. In other words, he's like out of his body. He's transported. He's having this out-of-body experience. And there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. Bonus question, throne in heaven, who's sitting on it? You guys are great Christians. Nothing gets by you. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, like a gemstone, shiny and translucent and otherworldly. A rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. Some sort of rainbow-type light. You get the impression that John is struggling to find language to describe exactly what he saw, but it's shiny, it's luminescent, it's otherworldly. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their heads. So what you're seeing here is like the headquarters of the universe, and of course God is at the center of it all. Well, that's not terribly surprising, but God at the center of it all, it's not just his being. It's like he radiates outward everywhere. That's kind of what John is trying to say, in a way that's visible and palpable. And around his throne are 24 other thrones. 12 is the number of government in the Bible, in Hebrew lore. And so 24 would be like the government of everything. It's not just God's government, but it's the world's government besides. It's like, so this 24 thrones around the throne of God equals all other authorities in the universe are there with God. He like controls them. They're wearing crowns and robes, so this sort of identifies them as, imagine all sources of authority in the universe, and they're all just looking at God for direction. That's the idea that the passage is trying to get across. From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumbling, and peals of thunder. So it's not just that God speaks, it's that his being affects. That's the picture. Before the throne, seven lamps were blazing. They're the sevenfold spirit of God. A lamp, a flame, is like the presence of God. So this would be like the omnipresent, the sevenfold. Seven is a symbolic number of completion and eternity and infinity in the Bible. So it's like the spirit of God that is everywhere, that's represented in the sort of sevenfold spirit before God. So you're looking at this headquarters, you're kind of seeing an illustration of the nature of God himself. He's over all authorities. His presence is everywhere. He doesn't just exist, he emanates. There's no boundary on him. You get the idea? Say amen, because I know it's weird. Also before the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal. In other words, there is no boundary under God. He can sort of see through everything, right? To God, all things are transparent. I'll pause here for a second and say, as I mentioned before, this is one of the favorite passages of the Bible for my family, because when my son Jeremiah was 4 years old, he got up one morning, came out and said, I had a dream. And that's like, I think it was heaven. And I saw like a king on a throne, and there was a big ice skating rink all around him. A sea of glass. And there's like this rainbow everywhere. Like he saw exactly this passage as a four-year-old in his dream. Of course, he had never read it and never heard it, but it just kind of tells me this is actually a real place. This is a real place. And the center around the throne were four living creatures. Now, here it gets trippy. Four is the number of gathering or, you know, it's like the four points of the compass. It's the number of like geography, that sort of thing. There are four living creatures, and they were covered with eyes in front and in back. Creepy? Beautiful? I don't know, but symbolic. What that means is that these creatures were embodiments of omniscience. Eyes everywhere means I see everything. So these were the creatures of God sees everything. Do you understand how this works? The first living creature was like a lion. The second was like an ox. The third had the face like a man. The fourth was like a flying eagle. Well, that makes sense. Probably needs no explanation. Well, a lion, what would that represent? Well, that's like a power and ferocity. And an ox is like the beast of burden, the servant. The man would be like, well, the image of God, creativity and intelligence. And the eagle was considered the most spiritual of all birds because the eagle flew high. And the ancient Hebrews used to watch the eagle molt and think that it was an internal bird who got its youth back every year. So it's like spirituality. So these symbols, these creatures represent like the nature of God. Like he's high, he's mighty, he's spiritual, but he's ferocious, he's scary, but he's also a servant, like an ox, you know? And he's also humble and with us like a man. You get the idea? Incredibly simple. It's telling you a story through symbols here. Each of the four living creatures had six wings, so they were capable of ascension. They were spiritual creatures. Six wings means three pairs. Three is the number of fellowship, you know, so they were part of, they look different, but they were all part of a heavenly spiritual fellowship. That's kind of what it's saying. Six wings and was covered with eyes all around, even under the wings. I don't know, eyes in the armpit, really? Day and night, they never stopped saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." It's like they're declaring the nature of God. God is different. God is different. And whenever the living creatures give glory, honor, and thanks to him who sits on the throne and who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him who sits on the throne. And they lay their crowns before the throne and say, "Worthy, you are worthy, O Lord our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and they exist because you created what you pleased." So there's sort of this constant declaration in heaven. God's creation echoing back, reflecting back to God, that he created it and that it was a joy to him to do it, that it's a good creation and a good fellowship that creation has with God, that the creatures of God, creation, that he sees all of them. And this is just the environment of heaven, right? The headquarters is an extension of God himself. Right, it's not that he gives orders, it's that he kind of is the headquarters. You know, it's like the walls of heaven pulse with the heart of God. The creatures of heaven, it's not like God doesn't just inhabit a physical space. Wherever God is, he creates life, and the life reflects the nature of God and extends it. You know, like it's a very holistic sort of environment. We are far too limited in the way that we think about space and time and beings. There are no boundaries as we normally understand them. And the authorities of heaven and the universe, the 24 elders, are constantly recognizing that God created it all, that things only make sense because God decided they would make sense. This is a creation, recognizing the sense and authority and meaningfulness of the Creator. And the 24 elders, they lay their crowns before him and say, "Worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. You created us. We make you happy." That's the first part of it. And then comes chapter 5. Then, this is John speaking, "I saw in the right hand of him who sits on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals." So in that day and age, if you saw a king with a scroll, you would think that it was a decree, right? An executive order, one might say. And it was sealed up, meaning that it was a message for a special person. Like you would send, the king would send a decree to a governor somewhere, and then the governor would open the decree, and then it would become law, and everybody would have to obey it. So this is kind of a symbolic picture of the will of God that hasn't unfolded yet. It hasn't been unfolded yet. But if you are in heaven and God is about to make a decree, you pay attention. So that's what's going on here. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" How does God's will become manifest in the universe? But no one in heaven, on earth, or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. So it's a picture, a momentary picture of God's will being thwarted. You know, there's still more to the story to come, and it hasn't unfolded yet. And John says, "I wept. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside." That's actually my favorite line of these chapters. It's like, if you saw things in reality and it looked to you for a moment that God's will would be thwarted, that the creator, the guy who did everything, who is everywhere and sees all and has all knowledge, if it occurs to you in reality that his will might not unfold as it should, you just break down and weep. The tragedy of it is so epic, you know. And I think of myself, because sometimes I know what God wants me to do, but I don't want to do it. And then what I do in my holiness is I complain at God. That's just me. I know you're all better Christians. But if we could really see things as they truly are and feel the presence of God, as John was feeling the presence of God in this moment, then just the hint that God's will would not be done automatically drives you to your knees in despair. And we see him, it says, weep and weep. He just came undone. He said, "Oh my gosh, this is the worst thing that ever happened. We are sunk. This is terrible." I love that. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Bible quiz, who is the Lion of the tribe of Judah and the Root of Jesse? Jesus. So this is Jesus of Nazareth. This is this historical figure that now re-enters the story here, not as the revelator, but as a character in the drama that John is seeing in headquarters. And everybody who would be reading the book of Revelation around, you know, Asia Minor or in the persecuted world would be, oh, that's him. That's our Jesus of Nazareth. That's the guy that just died and was resurrected. Like, oh, human history now is entering it. Like, we know that guy, and he's in heaven. And then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain. Who's that? So we're just kind of describing Jesus here. Standing in the center of the throne, meaning the space, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. We're used to throne rooms that kind of have a throne on one wall, but in heaven, the throne is in the middle of everything, and everything in the universe emanates outward from there. And so suddenly Jesus is right at the center of the universe, which in itself is a big message to the suffering Christians of the world. This tremendous figure, this person who has authority to unfold the will of God for the universe, he walks into the frame looking like a lamb who has been slain, or some translations would say like a slaughtered lamb. He is just beat up and desecrated, which is an interesting way for the king, the authority of heaven to look. He's encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. Horns represent authority. Eyes represent knowledge or seeing or wisdom. So again, Jesus shows up. He looks like a lamb who was slain. He has all authority. That's what seven horns means. And he has all seeing, all wisdom. That's what the seven eyes mean. The Spirit of God sent into all the earth. He's everywhere at once. He came and took the scroll. In other words, he's God, right? Jesus is God. That's the declaration. He came and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song. So you see that Jesus is really the center of God's drama, God's plan, God's existence. He's at the center of everything. That he has been slaughtered, but he also has been given all authority, and all authority in the universe. All the 24 elders recognize Jesus as the authority. The early Christians would have been amazed to have heard all of this. They were still trying to figure out the scale of the drama. And we see that even all godly observance, the prayers of the saints, are all sort of laid before Jesus. The prayer of all holy people through all ages are now given to Jesus in hopes that he would unfold the rest of the story in heaven. Are you following? And they sang a new song. And they said, "You are worthy to take the scroll and break its seals and open it, for you were slaughtered, and your blood has ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation." Like, we're 2,000 years into Christianity now, but I just want to point out what a weird statement that is. You are worthy to unfold the rest of God's plan, for you were slaughtered. Okay, that makes no sense. Because if someone gets slaughtered, that's typically a defeat. That's a bad thing. But there's something about Jesus' death that gives him authority and lets him use that authority to ransom people, to rescue people. It means literally from everywhere in the world. Every people, every nation. He is not Lord of the Jews. He is Lord of
everything. In other words, that would have been a shock to a lot of these early Christians. "And you have caused them to become a kingdom of priests for our God." Everybody the Lord rescues becomes a priest, becomes a minister, and they will reign on the earth. The people who follow Jesus will eventually have authority over all the earth. How does that sound? Sit up straight. The people who follow Jesus will reign over the earth. Why? Well, because Jesus was slaughtered. There's some way in which his suffering and his death entitles him to unfold the rest of the story now. And that's just, it's a little bit bizarre, right? And somehow we become his priests along the way. "Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands, 10,000 times 10,000, 1,000 thousands, 1,000 thousand is a million." That's like one math major. Millions upon millions of angels are now talking. It just tells you that the universe is teeming with life. There's not a vast emptiness, no. It is teeming with life. "And they encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders, and in a loud voice they sang, 'Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise.' And what makes them worthy?
His suffering
and his death. "Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them," and in other words, every bit of life in creation, "singing, 'To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever.'" We just sang that during the worship set. "The four living creatures said, 'Amen.' And the elders fell down and worshipped." Elders do a lot of falling down in heaven. There are a lot of calisthenics, right? There's a crowd. So that we understand this, I'm going to tell you what happens next in the story. Jesus takes the scroll and opens it, and it's the decree of God. And the thing that the decree releases is almost unimaginable suffering on the earth. And it tells you that the suffering that we undergo on earth and the great persecution that the early Christians were undergoing was actually purposeful, that God himself had released it in order to do something. And then in the book of Revelation, we find out what that something is and how his plan works out, which is interesting. Here's a way to think about Jesus that perhaps you never thought about before. But God's plan requires that we suffer. Requires that the earth suffer. It's hard to understand, but we begin to understand it as we go through the book of Revelation. But to release suffering on the earth, God doesn't just snap his fingers and make it happen. He said, that's not good enough. So before I release suffering on the earth, here's what I will do. I will undergo all of it myself. And only because God suffers is he entitled to release suffering on anyone else. It's a picture of incredible humility, right? Lest accusers come along. In Revelation, Satan is described as the accuser. And lest Satan comes along and says, oh, sure, you make your humans suffer. You make your animals suffer. You make nature suffer. But you never suffered yourself because you're all powerful and all knowing and the center of all things. And God said, wrong. This is how I'll do it. I will suffer, I will live humbly, I will undergo all your temptations, and then I will be slaughtered. I will be hung naked on the cross and jeered at and humiliated. And that's what gives me the right to invite people to undergo similar challenges. And had I not have done that, then all heaven would be weeping. You know, something would not have been as complete as it should have been. Following? That's what Revelation 4 and 5 are about. Now you guys are great interpreters. You understand all symbols. And if somebody asks you what it means to have seven horns on your head, now you know. You might be thinking, that's not practical knowledge, Jordan. I won't use that knowledge every day. But what it really is it's the picture of a reality behind the reality in which we normally live. You will use that knowledge every day if you're smart. If you're wise, you will go through the day with an awareness that Jesus has all authority and that the suffering that you see around you is designed to be purposeful. That the creative intent of God is in everything and everyone that you see, that sort of thing. Consider what you see and the experiences that you have on earth in terms of this absolute cosmic drama of staggering consequence and purpose. That's a lot to ask of a human being. It's going to require you to kind of be trippy and kind of think about weird things, sort of let your spirit soar into the heavens. And that's a capacity that needs to be cultivated. If there were, say, you know, a World War III going on right now, there was some sort of existential war on the planet, then everything that we did during the day would kind of be evaluated under the shadow of that war, right? It's like, well, I don't even know if we're going to exist next week. What if the nuclear bombs get launched? That sort of idea. And everything that you did would kind of be evaluated against that backdrop. Well, there is a great existential war being waged, right? And it's far bigger than any nuclear war that could happen on Earth. It is the drama of the ages. It has to do with redemption and ultimate suffering and eternal life. You know, not just the next 40 years of life, but you know, far greater things at stake. And here Jesus is just inviting you to evaluate every experience you have on earth under the shadow of the drama of the ages. And what do you call that kind of mindset? I don't know. It's expanded. It's trippy. It's prophetic. It's spiritual. Right? It's everything at once, right? It's part lion, part ox, part man, part evil. But you can't leave out the evil. You know, life is a very supernatural, spiritual thing of eternal consequence. And either that makes you feel a lot of pressure or it alleviates some pressure by broadening your mindset. Either the ultimate reality threatens you or it encourages you because there's an ultimate order to everything that's happening. It's not does enter me. There's something being played out. And if you want to boil it down to you, because you do, the suffering you're undergoing counts for a lot. It was probably authorized by Jesus. And that makes it count for a lot. You might not think so, but your prayers are collected in incense bowls in heaven, laid before Jesus. Remember this, Lord. Remember this. And that counts for a lot. If I wrote emails that God read, one, I'd write a lot of emails. Two, I'd write them carefully and with great intention and trust. And that's essentially what the incense bowls represent. Your suffering counts for a lot. Your communication, your attitude with God counts for a lot. These things get stored up, and they're actually valuable at headquarters itself, which tells you something. And any suffering that you overcome might actually get you a seat at headquarters someday. We'll read about that a little bit later in the book. So if I had a practical point to this sermon, it would probably simply be this. Don't forget reality. As you go through your life, just recall that most of it is a dim reflection of the greater reality. That every interaction you have with a human being is not just a temporary interaction, but it's a temporary interaction that could very well have eternal results. And every time you get frustrated by a disappointment in life, there is grief in it, but there is also undoubtedly purpose in it. Don't forget what reality is. You know, you say your bedtime prayers, just stop and think, okay, but what do I know is really going on? What's really going on? Because I think the main challenge that most of us have is that we live in a small fraction of reality. And that makes us a small fraction of what we should be. I think there's probably a portion of people today that might be a little bit like me, and what you do, you accuse God of doing things in your life that don't make sense. And the reason they don't make sense is because you don't see the complete picture. So I'm going to give you 30 seconds to think about that, about the complaints that you made to God about things that don't make sense.